So, we left off talking about when you had first come to Christ. What happened between that moment and between the time you joined the military?
Well, like I said, I just was on fire for the Lord, and Satan keeps working. So over time, it's like some things happened before I graduated from high school that family decided not to go to church anymore. Couldn't seem to find a good church, though I was still going periodically. Long and short of it was, though, it's like I needed to get out. Like I had to, all I could tell myself was that I had to get out of the aluminum plywood box, 10 by 60. And do something. There was something in me that said, I mean, I'm more than this. I've got to be more than this. I've got to do something. So I was working full time, and ended up graduating high school with honors. But before I did that, never forget, a recruiter came in. He kept coming into the place I was working at, a casino downtown in Las Vegas, and working at a restaurant on the outskirts of the outside of town, outside of the downtown area. But he kept coming into that restaurant. And he would be in there almost every Saturday, I don't know, like every Saturday morning, have a breakfast. And then finally one day he was like, "Hey, young man, how old are you?" So I told him, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And he was very squared away, sharp guy. Anyway, so he's like, "Hey, here's my card. Why don't you come on down, talk to me? No pressure, So okay. Went down there, started talking to him. And he's like, you think about the military?" I said, "No, it's actually been the thought in my head since I was a little kid." And he said, "Well, here's a book. Once you look through this book, tell me what you think. You have to take a test called the ASVAB. And if you do well enough on that, you could pretty much do whatever you want." And then in the Navy. I said, "Okay." So I talked to some military people that I knew, and they were like, "Hey, Navy's a great way to go, And so long story was, I went down, took the ASVAB. I did well enough. He's like, "You can do whatever you want, from the nuclear program to whatever." I said, "Well, I've been looking at this." I kind of had it in circles, and it was, just a little short blurb. I had no clue what I was getting into, quite honestly. And it looks like I could fly. I could, be a rescue swimmer. I could do this. I could do that. I had no clue. And so he's like, "Yeah, and I don't really know anything about that job field, but sounds cool. You get selected. You did well enough. I can give you a guaranteed schooling, track." I said, "Awesome. It'll be guaranteed to you. Just get through boot camp and, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Okay." So, what I didn't know is that it was going to be an almost 2-year training track, high attrition rate. And, so I just started what I call the pipeline, just started working my way through, and did well in boot camp. I got meritoriously advanced in boot camp to the next pay grade. And I was a squad leader and stuff in boot camp. And it seemed to, I was like a sponge. Like, I'm about this, So there's something inside me that said, "This is good. This is the way." So I went through the, started working my way through the training track. I was doing well in school. I was upper 10% of my class in every school that I was going to, physically and academically. And, I pat myself on the back and say, "It really is working out." And so then we got to rescue swimmer school. So that was, training of school number three, school number three. And you had to pass. Back in those days, you had to be physically capable, let's just put it that way, to get into the school. And it was run by Navy SEAL Master Chief and his cadre. Of course, the SEALs are very well known, and they're not going to just let you pass any course that they're running, of course. Very high attrition rate. At that time, it was a 70% attrition rate, failure rate for that school alone, failure and rollback. And I ended up like 12 weeks in that school in my second class. You had a period waiting for a class to start where they're building you up, then the class starts, and then that's, 4 or 5 weeks. And then you go through that training. It's very intense, every day, and physically in every other way. But anyway, long story it was, I got injured. Almost broke my ankle on a run one day, stepping in a hole. And then I got set back, had to, heal and get to the next class. So long story was, I was there 12 weeks. And then right after that school was SEER school. Now, before that, we'd done what at the time was known anti-submarine warfare operator A school. And that's where you first get into very secretive stuff. And that's why you have to have the minimum secret clearance, which later on you end up with a top secret clearance and stuff to put on the job that you have and things you're doing. But bottom line is that's, you know, you've got to be cleared for a secret clearance, national agency check, you know, and never been arrested, all these things. That's secret clearance. So, but that's begins the very secretive stuff, anti-submarine warfare, which is all about keeping the battle group safe from enemy submarines and all that goes into that. And, you know, when I tell you, it's kind of hard to grasp, but it's like you have the ability to know the major nations of the world, their submarines, their acoustic signatures. It's like every submarine's got its own thumbprint. The ability to pull that up on your scope and decipher between all the noise in the battle group, what is a submarine, what isn't a submarine, just acoustically, on top of sonar and radar and all this stuff, you know, oceanography, sound propagation through water, plate tech, under ocean plate tectonics. I mean, all this stuff, it's very in depth, and it's academically demanding. So, yeah.
Well, you talked about SEER school. What is that exactly? What do you learn there? Because I think it's an interesting part, but I don't really know exactly what it means.
Yeah. So SEER school is kind of a common link for special operations guys. Now, the community I came from, of course, I don't even think we knew it at the time, but it's an aviation special operations community in the Navy. Now, you're not special forces. You're not spec war like Navy SEALs or Green Beret or, you know, 75th Ranger Regiment and, you know, others, Delta, you know, but you are a special operations guy. What you do in the Navy is different than what anybody else does, especially in the helicopter community, because we're not only anti-submarine warfare operators, which has all the special knowledge that you have locked in your brain that has to be protected, but you also in the job field do multiple helicopter-based missions, board search, seizure, counter-narcotics, counter-piracy, counter-service threat, you know, stuff, search and rescue, combat search and rescue, where you may be flying behind enemy lines to go get, you know, our people out. It may be down pilots or special operations units that you're trying to get out of there, or other troops doing medical evacuation. I mean, on and on it goes. So, and so a lot of these things you can do without even being at war, but part of that, there's a two-pronged thing that's now going to put you in a collision course with SEER school, making that a requirement. And it's called SEER Level C or SEER Level Charlie, which is the highest level survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, S-E-R-E. And so two things. One is that special knowledge you have in your brain, which has to be protected in case you ever get captured. And number two is because the missions that you fly, you could end up in close contact with the enemy or being shot down behind enemy lines, now taken prisoner. You have to have the ability to know, have some skill sets that you're going to learn in SEER school that are going to help you project that knowledge. And you know, and because of the helicopter community, like I knew all about fleet operations. I know how the ships operate. I actually spent time on two separate fast attack submarines on top of that. And so I had a broad base of knowledge that can be very useful for an enemy if they can extract that from my mind. Does that make sense? So now you're in this school. SEER school is all about two things. One is land survival, which is you're out there living off the land for here's kind of how the school goes. You spend a week in class learning the importance of what SEER school is, how it was built, that all of the tortures our previous troops went through in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, things that were done to them. And why it's important to protect the information. And what became incredibly important to me was the American Fighting Man's Code of Conduct. I memorized it because it is your guide when you're behind enemy lines, taken captive by the enemy. So it's about your code of conduct, how you conduct yourself in unison with your comrades. Or if you're isolated and you're on your own, I'm not going to give aid and comfort to the enemy. I'm not going to take special favors from the enemy. I'm going to keep faith with my comrades. I will never give up unless I absolutely have to. If I have the ability to resist, I'm going to resist in every way, shape, and form. On and on it goes. So that code of conduct is part of this course of study. And I took it very seriously to heart and memorized it. And then the land survival. So you do the classroom for a week. Then you go into the field for a week. You're out there living off of land, learning both group and single navigation, evasion techniques, how to not be captured, camouflage, all of these things, how to avoid being captured and then actually get rescued, hopefully out of that situation. But then after that, there's a final evasion where you get teamed up with a partner. And I teamed up with a buddy of mine from Rescue Swimmer School. And then they send, now bad guys are after you. Like, they're hunting you down. It's no joke. They're totally different uniforms. Back in the day, the Russians were our Cold War enemy, if you will. So the guys are out there, the bad guys are on black fatigues, red stars on the uniforms, black berets, red stars on those, red stars on their vehicles, and their vehicles are all painted black. And they come now and hunt you down. And they've got, dogs and this and that, and they're after you. And they've got AK-47s. Long and short of it is, no matter how it goes, no matter how well you evade, eventually you got to give up. And they're going to take you into a prisoner of war camp. And you spend some days in there. And it's feels like an eternity, because you already are sleep deprived. You're already food deprived for a week. Then you get put in there and you're sleep deprived, you're food deprived, they're not going to let you die, but they're not going to, and the lack of sleep and the lack of food, all that begins to wear on you. And now you are in the middle of very intense, both physical and psychological interrogations. And it's intense. And, they make us sign a non-disclosure agreement, but guys have been writing books about this stuff now for some years, but I don't know how much you can and can't say, except to say that I can tell you that I was knocked unconscious in there a number of times. They have an implement that we've now outlawed called the waterboard, where they make you believe you're definitely going to die. Putting a wet towel over your face on an incline and then pouring water over and interrogating you in between. And here's what I found. And again, I'm saying this. Understanding, I was with a group of 53 guys. I was war criminal number 44, because that's what they call you once you get in the prison war camp. Geneva Convention does not exist. That stuff does not happen because you're a war criminal. They classify you, the bad guys classify you as a war criminal. They don't have to treat you under Geneva Convention rules, right? So that's just how it goes. And, back in those days, I'll never forget July 1982 when I was in SEER school and SEER level C. And all I can tell you is it's very intense. It will test your mettle. It will make you figure out who you are and what all these things that you think that you are. It will strip it away from you. Then you find out who you are.
Well, in part one of your story, we talked about how much abuse and suffering you had to go through as a child. I can't imagine there's many people that have gone through more than you, even at that school that you were at, this year's school. Do you think that helped you go through the things that you had to endure? Obviously, you can't talk about some of the things that they did to you, and I don't want you to talk about it if you can't, but it was definitely gruesome and hard. Do you think your experience as a child helped you?
I think it may have. I guess my thought is, here's the thing. I think really bad things happening to us does one of two things to us. It either breaks us in many ways that then, flesh themselves out through our lives, or it provides us a level of something in us. And for me, all I can tell you is that in SEER school, the harder they pushed me, the more they did to me, the more I was determined to resist. And like I wanted to the nth degree live out the American Fighting Man's creed there, and I use that to guide me. But it definitely, here's the thing, I wasn't afraid of pain. I wasn't afraid of, now I'm saying that not with bravado. Here's what I know, having read the true stories and heard the eyewitness testimonies of real prisoners of war who were decimated, broken bones, starved, beaten. Well, we did barely scratching the surface. So understand, I'm saying that in the context of that. And they will find a way to bring you enough pain to break you. You will give something to them. That's part of what the school teaches you. when you finally reach a point where you've got a gun to your head, you better tell them something to make them not want to pull the trigger. You better make yourself likable enough and understandable enough and give them just enough to keep them from killing you, because ultimately you want to survive and come home to fight another day. So what I will say is that the harder they pushed me, the more things they did to me, and they did a lot, the more isolated they made me because of my resistance. And that's what they did. They isolated me from everyone, and they just went in on me, and they did a good job of it. So I would say that the stuff that happened to me made me not afraid. Like, I've been in some hard stuff. And no matter what happens here, I'm not going to acquiesce to your demands just like that. Now, and I'm saying that to say, as much as someone who's a military person may listen to this and say, well, it's a bunch of bravado and you're lying. I'm not lying when I say I was a 19-year-old kid and I was selected as the honor man of my class of 53 people that had both pilots, 9 guys from my training pipeline and my job field, and some other special operations guys. I think we had one Navy SEAL, an Army Special Forces guy. I don't know what he was in our class for, an Air Force Special Operations people. They're also there with us, of the 53. So, and I didn't even know I was selected. It's really amazing, because at the end of it all, there's only certain specifics I can't really get into, because I might have already stepped over the line of the non-disclosure saying what the things they did to me, but I did to all of us in there, quite honestly. But a select few got extra attention. I made myself, unfortunately, in the special operations community, they thought I'd be in a gray man, be the guy just barely even noticeable. And in a lot of places in the world, that's who you want to be. And that's cool to resist, to push that boundary of resisting the enemy, is going to make you non-gray man. It's going to make you noticeable and known. And I will say, that's what they say they selected me for, was for my resistance. Like, I passed the school. There were times they took a gun out, put it to my head, and then I gave them a little something, but I gave them the least I could possibly give them and made them work to get any more out of me. And they worked me for it, trust me. So I guess the bottom line is that at the end of the school, I'll never forget, bro. It was like this. So you line up by rank. So all 53 of us are lined up by rank, highest rank up front, lowest rank in the back. So me and my 9 buddies are in the very back, because I got meritoriously advanced in boot camp. I'm the senior of the 9 of us, by a few months or whatever. But we get ready to march out. And I'll never forget senior ranking officer in the school was a lieutenant commander. And he had had some challenges from Jump Street. I mean, he didn't do so well. From the first slap across the face, he started to crumble. And I never saw him again. But then again, I was resisting to the as far as I could push it. And I got so isolated, I hardly remember much being around any leadership at all. That wasn't happening for me. But I'll never forget, we're forming up to march out. This after everything's done, it's over. And we're forming up to march out of the camp. And the senior ranking officer says, "Emory Prentice Hancock, front and center." So I run over there, "Boarding's ordered, sir." He's like, "You march us out of here. You earned it." And I'm like, "What? I don't know. I don't know what's going on." I'm like, "Roger that, sir. Sir." So he goes and steps in my line and ranks, in my position and ranks, and I call cadence, I march us out. Forward, right, oh, look, yep, but now march everybody out. So I don't know what's going on, but it's like, I've been ordered to march us out, so that's what I'm doing. So then at the debrief, at Naval Air Station North Island out in San Diego, Coronado, we're sitting in this big auditorium, and it's one of those U-shaped auditoriums, like a college auditorium kind of thing, and they've got these guys on stage and a bunch of really, for real deal, former, prisoners of war from Vietnam and such are now, telling their stories, talking about how important the school is and why, and here's their story. And like, wow, man, these guys are tortured, man. It's just, what we just did is nothing. And that's all I could think, man. I'm choking up listening to their stories. I'm like, I didn't do anything. But then they start profiling our class, like, hey, hard sell, which is where they use physical stuff to try to make you give information. Your average guy went into hard sell for this amount of time. Your you know, they profiled our class and just like, your leadership broke down, you had problems, but then a couple junior officers stepped up, blah, blah, blah. There were some guys that were resisting pretty hard that gave an example of the other guys, yada, yada. And anyway, so then they start learning about, you know, how long we were in hard cell, then soft cells were the psychological interrogation in various ways that can really get you, man, really, you don't even know you're giving information, like, you know, you messed up. Well, I was very staunch. I had clarity of mind. I was able to be on point when I was in soft cell, and then they got nothing from me except resistance. So I pat myself on the back. It just worked out that way. So they were talking about all that, how long the guys were in hard cell, how long they were in soft cell, the general, you know, how things went generally for the class, how the leadership initially broke down, which was true, and this and that, but how we kind of got back on our feet, and how some guys resisting gave an example of the other guys. And they said, your honor man was one of those guys. He was that primary guy, as a matter of fact, that resisted. He paid a price. You know, he was in hard cell this many times. He was in soft cell this many times, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, as they're telling this story, I'm looking around because we're in this cheap thing and we're all in by, you know, rank again. And I'm sitting way down here and I'm looking, I'm like, who is this guy? That guy took a beating, man. This guy's still alive. Holy cow, let me see that guy. And so finally they said, Eric President Hancock, stand up. And I stood up. I'm like, this is how stupid I am. I still don't know what's going on. And so they said, here's your honor, man. Well done, sailor. Good job. Well done. And of course, everybody stands up and they're clapping, bro. It hit me so finally hit me so hard. I started tearing up. Like, the kid from my background goes through some very tough training. Then I get to this training, which is, anybody who's been SEER level C, if you ever talk to anybody else, they're going to never forget it. Trust me. But that kid is a 19-year-old young man now, and of a 53 guys of, from pilots, you know, go fast jet pilots to special operations guys, is the honor man of this never forget hard training.
The important part to mention that we mentioned in the other, in the part one of the story, is how you grew up and how you had no love and how everybody treated you as subhuman for the beginning of your life. And so having this recognition from people that were people that you respected meant much more to you than it would have to somebody that had a much easier life.
For sure. For me personally, it meant a lot because, quite honestly, I think maybe it's a broken thing, but I think it's this for a lot of men in general. Like, what you do in life becomes part of who you are. And there's a certain level of respect that a man wants in himself of that thing. And I believe God puts that in us. And whether you're the best janitor or you're the best carpenter or you're the best mechanic or you're the best teacher, whatever it is, I've always been driven, especially because I think it's an identity thing. Like I find it important to find acceptance within whatever community I'm in to be one of the best. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's a quality that you need to have when you're in the military. You need to want that in the first place, to be interested in joining, to want the camaraderie and to want to be respected. And I don't think you'll get too far in the military if you don't have that mindset. But I want to move on to later on, because we just talked about the training so far. As you became a Navy chief, what's the craziest story that you have to tell?